All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We got a packed show for you today, so I'm just going to like move right into it, okay? At the back end of the show, we are going to be talking about something that I rarely get a chance to really dive into and give you a lot of examples of, and that is the role of art and artists in a situation like today, where all hell is breaking loose, where we're looking at the world and we want to know, what the hell are we going to do about it? And we look to different expressions of hopefulness, all right? And things that can actually inspire, also lay bare some things that can get us mad, that can actually stand up and talk to us in ways that we don't normally get in normal times. And so what I'm going to be doing at the back end of the show is giving you a few examples of some of the art that has come out in relation to the genocidal assaults on black youth that's been sweeping the country over the last few months. So we're going to be listening to some of the work from some of the artists who have been very moved by the whole situation today and have produced some remarkable, powerful art. So stay tuned. You definitely don't want to miss this segment. Before that, we'll be talking with attorney Martin Garbus about an editorial he wrote in the Los Angeles Times. The title of that editorial was Cruel and Usual Punishment. And it's an editorial speaking out against mass incarceration and the assault on black and Latino people in this country, all right? This is an extremely important subject and an important part of the show, so stay tuned for that one. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to be bringing back to the show Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a regular guest on the show. She's also a writer for Revolution Newspaper and one of the founders of StopPatriarchy.org. And if you recall, back in the beginning of September, we were talking with Sansara at a time when a ruling was standing before the Court of Appeals in Texas, and that ruling was actually, they had stopped the closure of all but six abortion clinics in Texas, and there was the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride that was in Texas for a month, fighting against those closures, fighting against the war on women, that was concentrated up at that time in the threat to close down all those abortion clinics in Texas and the implementation of those laws that basically would mean women became chattel slaves, okay? That's basically what it meant. And as listeners to this show know, Sansara is also one of the organizers of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride in Texas this last summer during August and early September. All right, and if you were listening to the show and following all this this past summer and early fall, you'll know that here's how the story goes. The Texas legislature implemented a lot of laws that would have forced the closing of all but six abortion clinics in the state of Texas. Then late this summer, a Texas court issued a ruling that put a stay on the closures of all these clinics. And then the U.S. Circuit Court in New Orleans issued a ruling that actually reversed the Texas court. And so it looked like, and in fact, as you'll hear when we talk with Sansara, it did have the immediate effect of closing many of the abortion clinics in Texas. But just a short while before we talked with Sansara this week, the U.S. Supreme Court put a stay on the ruling of the U.S. Circuit Court in New Orleans. And so I think we'll open up our discussion with Sansara on that. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you back. And when we originally spoke about having you on, we were going to be talking about this outrageous ruling in the Court of Appeals upholding the Texas legislature's attempt to close down all but six abortion clinics in Texas. But now something new has happened. What's up?
Well, so there was an outrageous decision of the Fifth Circuit Court in New Orleans, which did uphold the Texas law, HB2, which closed down all but eight abortion clinics, as it turned out. They had 46 clinics as recently as 2011. They were down to eight as of last week because of this ruling at the Fifth Circuit. Just today, the Supreme Court has temporarily blocked those closures. And the reason they've done this, as I understand it, this is very new, so I'm learning it just momentarily before we spoke, is that it's not a ruling on the constitutionality of the law and the restrictions on abortion. It's just to say that while it's still being adjudicated, while it's still being appealed, they are going to grant the clinics the right to operate. And I imagine this would be because it puts an incredible burden on the business to be shut down and forced not to operate for months while it's going through appeals. Mostly that'll drive these abortion clinics out of business. And so it could be very well that the Supreme Court is making this decision based on standards of business interests having nothing to do with standards of abortion care and abortion access. So it's not really a ruling on abortion per se, but it is a very, very positive thing and has the immediate impact of enabling the clinics who are able to open up and once again serve women in vast stretches of Texas, which is a huge, enormous geographic state where all but 8 clinics and only those were all in the urban areas. Nothing was available to women south or west of San Antonio, which, if you don't know, Texas is hundreds of miles to the south and hundreds of miles to the west. And so that could very well change, and that's really important. At the same time, I have to say, and all of this we'll learn more in the next days, but some of those clinics are most likely not going to be able to reopen because they've already laid off their staff, they've already not extended leases because they didn't see the basis to open. And if they do, they're still running a major risk. If you reinvest, you rehire your staff, you reopen your clinic, you re-license, you redo everything, and any day they could still be closed down. So it's really the right thing to do for them to reopen, but it is a costly gamble, and there's no guarantee. And so this is, you know, the entire situation remains very fraught. It remains very dangerous, both for women and for the people who are providing abortions. At the same time, it's obviously a very good development that this law was blocked, and so we'll see how this unfolds in the next few days.
Now, tell me this, Ansar. When we were initially speaking about this throughout the course of August and early September, whenever we spoke, you would bring up the point that if the courts upheld the state legislature and, you know, basically backed up all the requirements that would fundamentally mean forcing the closure of all these clinics, that all of these clinics would, in fact, begin to shut down immediately. Did that happen?
The clinics did close. They were forced, when the decision was made October 2nd, the next day they had to cancel appointments with women who were scheduled to have abortions. Those women showed up. And they were told that they, you know, the clinics that could, they worked with them to reschedule and to help the women find out how far they had to travel, where else they needed to go. The 8 clinics that remained open were flooded with patients. And the women who need to make appointments are having an extraordinarily difficult time. I know in New Mexico, more women are traveling across the state line from western Texas to go and get abortions in New Mexico. So this has already had a very negative impact on women. And again, it's setting precedent. It's setting precedent. It's setting the standards. And it's taking abortion access out of the reach of many, many women. And it's further, you know, when you give legal backing to the closure of abortion clinics, to forced motherhood, you are shaming and further stigmatizing the procedure, the providers, and the women who get them, even the ones who can access them because they remain in the urban areas where it's available. And so, you know, and it sets a precedent for the country. So this remains one of the sharpest, most dangerous anti-women battles that's raging in the country right now.
Just let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and StopPatriarchy.org, and one of the organizers of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. You know, one of the things that it's interesting you bring that up, because one of the things that's been happening a lot in the pages of the LA Times recently is a focus on abortion and abortion rights and the whole situation. And like, for instance, one of the weekend editions printed a huge article about, basically, the sense you got off of that article was that there was this whole war against the right to an abortion across the country. And it was pretty, you know, it was interesting because it was a pretty solid description of things. And then just recently, they had another article that I thought was something that was really incredible. They ran a piece about the last abortion clinic in South Dakota and the abortion doctor that provides abortions there and what life is like. And for the women in particular, and the massive amount of struggle they have to go through to be able to get an abortion. And it was really incredible. It really drove home a lot of what you're talking about in terms of what is the future if all this is allowed to go on unopposed and allowed to be implemented.
Yeah, it's true. You know, just to round out the picture, in Alabama, they just passed a law that is tightening the restrictions and the requirements of parental consent for women who are not 18 years old. And so if you're a teenager in Alabama and you need an abortion, and you find yourself pregnant, and frankly, nobody who's a teenager who finds themselves pregnant should be having a baby. I mean, that's not the kind of society we should have. I'm not saying they should be forced to have an abortion, but they certainly should have it available, and they should have people encouraging them to not feel any guilt or remorse over terminating a pregnancy. But if they want to get an abortion, they need parental consent. If they, for whatever reason, can't tell their parents or are afraid to tell their parents, if their parents won't give them permission, even if they do tell their parents, and many of the young women who are impregnated, it's from family members, especially the very young women. But if they want to go to a judge to bypass parental consent, the state of Alabama will now appoint a lawyer to defend the fetus and the interests of the fetus up against the interests of that young woman or that girl. And this is telling you something about, you know, the dehumanization of women, the dehumanization of girls, the subjugation, the legal subjugation, and the codifying them, the passing into law that they are vessels, they are breeders, they are not full human beings, and granting the rights of human beings to the fetuses. And a lawyer for a fetus, I mean, the whole idea, fetuses are not people. And the whole idea is absurd, but it gives you a glimpse. And anybody, this is part of a national pattern. It does reveal where it's going. And the anti-abortion movement is against birth control. They're against sex education. They really do believe that it is women's duty to bear children, and that's why they are about criminalizing abortion. They're putting women in prison for miscarriages. They're putting women in prison for self-inducing abortions or helping their relatives and loved ones to self-induce abortions. This has never been about concern over babies or concern over women. It's about controlling women. And I think that the situation in South Dakota, the situation in Alabama, and it's intensifying everywhere. But people in the urban areas, people on the coasts, people in L.A. and New York and Chicago should not have illusions, because the anti-abortion movement is not going to stop until they've criminalized all abortions for all women in all circumstances. And every victory they make in the courts, no matter where it is, it's immoral for us to abandon the women in Alabama or South Dakota and not fight against that. It's immoral, but it's also delusional, because that will, the precedent set there, will be part of the building blocks that they use to then encroach upon and close down abortion everywhere else, and they will not stop until they do. Mm-hmm. And this is why we have to fight against this. The other thing is that the idea that we can rely on the politicians, or that we can rely on the courts, or that we can rely on the electoral process to protect this right is a deadly illusion. People have tried that for decades, and we've been losing and losing and losing and losing, because it's a much deeper battle than that. It's not an election ploy. It's about big structural shifts in imperialist America and the resurrection of traditional patriarchy, Christian fascism, a whole social contract that's being hammered into place that's very useful to the ruling class, a section of it, and that the other section of the ruling class grouped around the Democrats do not want to fight. Even if they don't fully agree with it, they don't want to fight it, because they share too much of the same interests of the empire. And so, you know, there's a need for reasserting the family, for patriarchy, for tradition, for patriotism. And if we don't step out and fight against that as the people who do not want to see women enslaved to their reproduction, who do not want to see women forced to have children against their will, if we don't step out and fight that, relying on ourselves and demanding abortion on demand and without apology and telling the truth about that and changing people's minds about that and winning them to stand up and struggle with us, then if we don't do that, then we should just recognize that we are going to let this future unfold, because it's not going to go away by itself. And you are either going to see women enslaved to their reproduction, or we're going to fight and defeat this as a part of building up the strength to, in my view, to make a revolution, to get rid of the whole system that leads to this, but wherever you're coming from on that, to stand up and fight and dislodge this program of forced motherhood, which is very far along, very determined, very powerful, and will not relent on its own.
Let me ask you one short question here. Well, first, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and StopPatriarchy.org, and one of the organizers of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride that kind of just rolled through Texas, raising some hell for the last month of the summer. Now, Sansara, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, when you left Texas, you had obviously made a big, you know, there was a big dent in the way things were. There was a big, you know, impact on the way things were, in a certain sense, where you really reached out to a lot of people, and if people go to the stoppatriarchy.org, you can, you know, watch all, and actually if you go to revcom.us, you can watch all of the kinds of the testimonies from all the women that you met, both who became part of the ride, but also women you met throughout the course of the abortion rights freedom ride. When you left there and then this ruling comes out, was there, you know, were there people that you had met who were still, who were standing up and fighting against this?
Well, there were people. There's a lot of people that we met throughout Texas. One of the things that we're struggling with in Texas and across this country is to actually make a leap in the level of organization and determination to take up this fight and to rely on ourselves. We're having a big, you know, we're having a big struggle with people, both those in the traditional pro-choice movement as well as people much more broadly in society, that precisely what I just said to you and your listeners, that if we don't want to see women forced to have children against their will, if we want to not go down that road to that future, we have to stand up and fight. We have to take responsibility for this. And that's a leap. People are used to donating to a political campaign. People are used to going and voting every couple of years. People are used to hoping that somebody else will take care of this for them or being glad that somebody else is out there. It's a very different thing. It's, you know, we're seeing people stand up in Ferguson, which is very important, taking matters into their own hands, not being patient and waiting for the criminal justice system or injustice system to grind itself into another, you know, unjust ruling. But in the realm around abortion right now, in the realm around women, people have to, they have to learn from that. They have to adopt that spirit. They have to make a leap in not waiting for the official bourgeois political process to grind forward and churn out more unjust rulings and more closures, and instead to stand up and fight ourselves. So there were people who stepped out and resisted, both in Texas and around the country, who protested, but not nearly on the scale that there needs to be. And so this is a big mission that StopPatriarchy.org is undertaking, to call forward the kind of mass independent political struggle, literally millions of people across this country, to battle against politically what's being done in Texas, Alabama, and across this country to women around abortion. And in particular, we're looking towards and mobilizing people for major protests and outpourings on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade, January 22nd, coming up, to counter what every year is an enormous march for forced motherhood every year on that anniversary.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that, because I saw on revcom.us, I saw the call, or I guess it was a draft call for a truly mass outpouring for abortion on demand without apology for Roe v. Wade 2015. And can you give people a sense of what you're talking about there? What are you looking at? And how is this going to, you know, take off?
You know, one of the things, people think that on abortion, everybody's got their minds made up, and it's two fixed positions that nobody will ever budge. And most people have a strong opinion one way or the other. But what we found in the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride last year and this year, all across Texas, was that nobody in a long time has been challenged to change their thinking on this question. People who say they're against it have never been challenged and argued with about what this really will mean for women's lives. And we went out there and we argued with people and we mobilized protests. And over again, I have to tell you, we had people who started out saying they're pro-life, they disagreed, who'd leave with an abortion on demand without apology sticker on, because we would talk with them and struggle with them about what this meant. And the idea is that we actually have to take that and ratchet it up on a societal level. We did that one-on-one in the street. We got out to millions through the media. But we have to take a major leap. Everybody who believes that women are full human beings, not incubators, needs to be part of standing up in a mass, public, uncompromising way on January 22nd in Washington, D.C. and in the Bay Area, where the two major anti-abortion marches are. We're going to be there with a march for abortion on demand and without apology. And we're going to put that into society in a major way and fight to change how millions are thinking, to mobilize those who support this, to stand up and fight because the future depends on it, and to start to change and argue with those who don't feel that but who've never heard the argument made. And to people who consider themselves pro-choice, I know a lot of people, they bristle at that slogan, abortion on demand and without apology. They think it's too extreme. But I have to say, if you're pro-choice and you don't agree with that, then you have to answer, which women do you think should be denied an abortion? Which women should be forced to have a child they don't want? And which women should be forced to feel ashamed and to apologize for getting abortions? And the fact is, nobody should. And so that's a, it's a very important slogan. And if and we have to be less apologetic. We have to not concede an inch of moral high ground to the Christian fascists and those who've been brainwashed by them with the anti-scientific rhetoric about fetuses. We have to be out there, and we cannot concede the moral high ground to them. We have to reclaim it and talk about women's lives, women's liberation, and that requires abortion on demand and without apology. So we're mobilizing people from the students, from the neighborhoods, from all artists and others, all sections of society, to come out in the streets and manifest and to rally others to say that from here on out, there's bigger battles coming in the courts and in every realm. From here on out, our side is going to be active, it's going to be loud, it's going to be in the streets, and we're not going away.
All right, Sansara Taylor, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay, talk to you again soon. Take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor from Revolution Newspaper, StopPatriarchy.org, and one of the organizers of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with our discussion with attorney Martin Garbus about the cruel and usual punishment of mass incarceration and solitary confinement. Stay tuned.
That grace founded on two-thirds a person, rapings and beatings and suffering that worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things. Black rage is founded on blatant denial, squeezed economics, subsistence survival, deafening silence.
Welcome back. That was Lauryn Hill with Black Rage Sketch. That's a song she released in honor of Michael Brown after he was murdered by the Ferguson police. Okay, I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show Martin Garbus. Martin is a leading trial attorney in the U.S. who's tried cases throughout the country involving constitutional, criminal, copyright, and intellectual property law. He's also known as basically one of the most ferocious litigators, especially when it comes to First Amendment and Eighth Amendment cases. And he's known for his defense of human rights around the world as well, for which he was named a Fulbright Scholar. Over the course of his life so far, he has been court-martialed, jailed, threatened with life in prison for his role as an unindicted co-conspirator in the Pentagon Papers case. Quite a badge of honor, and he continues to really work like hell for some very good causes. Martin, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. I recently woke up about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, and I looked at the LA Times and went to the editorial page and saw your op-ed piece, and it was about cruel and unusual punishment in jails and prisons. And when I read it, you know, there's a point where you can sort of, some people get a little jaded and they say, okay, yeah, we're going to, you know, this is going to be telling me again that this is bad. But I've paid a lot of attention to what's happening in the jails. And when I read your op-ed piece, I was really moved about that because, you know, you took it from not just the...
Thank you very, very much.
Yes, yeah.
You know, when one writes something like this, you don't know whether the with people are inundated or whether it'll get through. But thank you.
Right. And it's important because you wrote it with both a lot of like knowledge and acumen, but you also wrote it with a lot of heart. I thought that was extremely important in terms of reaching
thank
people
you.
Around this. Yeah. Now, you say that cruel and unusual punishment in jails and prisons is unconstitutional but normal. Well, let's start with just how normal is it? How widespread is it? How normal is it?
Well, prisons are basically lawless places where you have very little right, if you're a prisoner, to complain about most anything that happens to you. And the more confining the prison is, from medium security to, let's say, maximum security, the fewer rights you have. Now, your rights are taken away from you by all kinds of subtle means and subtle measures. If I had given the names, for example, of any of the people who spoke to me, they would, and I did not identify even the prisons in the article, except Rikers Island, which was identified in some other stuff. If any prisoner had told me those stories, either about himself or about any other person, and I were to give that person's name, one can be sure that that person would get into a certain kind of trouble. By a certain kind of trouble, I mean bad marks on your record, aggressive action by guards, which would then become unbearable. So there are, I've litigated cases. You have a due process hearing allegedly required under certain circumstances. But, you know, Letty Bruce had that, who I represented, also had that remark, in the halls of justice, the only justice is in the halls. And by that, I think he meant away from where the law looks and in dealing with life. So that prisoners who were in solitary confinement, who were in isolation, who were in for a long time, have to develop extraordinary measures to be able to deal with the imprisonment, measures I'm sure that I could not function within. So you can come up with, I tell some of the stories in the piece about what prisoners have told to me. There's a lot I don't tell because I visit some of those prisoners now, and it would be too specific to those prisons and those prisoners. But cruel and unusual punishment comes, I mean, the argument became better known in the 60s and 70s when we used it to try and strike down capital punishment. And as you know, we won a great many cases, but we never won the final case, which strikes down all state murders as cruel and unusual punishment. When we started that struggle years ago, there were hundreds and hundreds of executions throughout the United States. The number may have been into the thousands. And now it's really just a trickle, which is not to say that it's not horrific. You know, as time goes on, probably it'll all dwindle down because of various impediments. But cruel and unusual punishment was generally saved, the argument was saved for capital punishment. Now it's being used in prisons. One of the things, of course, you're going through in California is these horribly overcrowded prisons. The result of those overcrowded prisons results in people being put in cells and being held in solitary confinement where they shouldn't be in solitary confinement. And that occurs both because of the paucity of cells and because of the inadequate monies for guards. So it's easier to take somebody or two people, put them in a cell, isolate them, not look in on them for days on end, other than to give them food, and sometimes to even skip that, and then horrific things happen. And then also what my article talks about is the conflation, if you will, between mental illness and solitary confinement. Prisoners who may or may not be guilty of anything, are put in solitary confinement when they're picked up before trial, before they're adjudicated of guilt, and they go into these solitary confinement cells, which was not made for them. People don't look at them. And as in the Rikers Island prisoner who I mentioned, they die. In that particular case, a Marine, ex-Marine, 56 years old, was arrested for being homeless on the street. He couldn't post a bond. He had a history of bipolar behavior and schizophrenic behavior. Now, he acted up a bit. They put him in a solitary confinement cell. They didn't look at him for a long period of time. His cell was over 100 degrees. He died. The official at Rikers Island said he was, quote, baked like a clam, end quote. Mm. And at the time he died, his body temperature was 103 degrees. He had been lying by himself in the cell for a long period of time, was covered with vomit and blood. So these stories are now starting to arise. I think people are starting to focus on it. That's why I was pleased what you said about my article. One doesn't know when there's too much. And the fact that, however it be, one or two people or more than that will be influenced by something like my article, which, by the way, was ultimately reprinted in Dallas, in the Dallas paper, the Florida paper, the Buffalo paper. It was reprinted in about two dozen papers. So it's had a national audience, and I'm very pleased about that.
Yeah, extremely important. Now, you know, one of the things, Martin, that when you were talking about, well, first let me remind listeners that we're talking with Martin Garbus, attorney who basically actually he specializes in saying, no, you're not going to screw around with humanity like this. I'm not going to stand by and let this happen, no matter where you are or who you are. But one of the things, Martin, that really comes across in this, you know, when you're talking about what's going on in all these different places, one of the things that we have here in California is you have these secure housing units, the SHU units, and there are also variations of that all over the country in terms of these supermax prisons. And these, you know, are really, you want to talk about cruel and unusual. This seems to be taking that to even new heights, just unprecedented heights in terms of the actual torture of the people who are put into them. And these kinds of things have actually been declared by the UN, the Special Rapporteur on Torture, as actually being torture, right?
Yes, the UN Rapporteur has described it as torture. Amnesty International has described it as torture. Thus far, we have not had any courts defining a day or two. It has to be a whole confluence of events that generally end up in death. before the Supreme Court will condemn it as torture. And I think with the Roberts Court, it's unlikely that this court will do it. Had the court been the Warren Court, your wonderful governor, who then became Supreme Court Justice, there might have been a different result. That was the court ultimately that, well, with a few changes, that led to the hope that capital punishment would be abolished.
You know, one of the things that when I was thinking about that, I've interviewed people, including the hikers that were held in Iran. I've also interviewed people who came out of the SHU units in California and other maximum security prisons. And I also, this morning, I read something on the site Solitary Watch about a man, a prisoner who's been in solitary for, right, I don't know, decades or something. Long story short, he had taken in a mouse that had been injured in the hallway, and it became his friend. And he tells this very long, very heartfelt story of how this mouse actually began to mean so much to him. And when he left his cell one day, he came back and a guard had come in and killed this mouse and left the body laying there. And I kept thinking about just the horrific levels that these systems go to,
right,
to actually carry out this dehumanization, which is really what this is about. It's the dehumanization and the total isolation and dehumanization of whole groupings of people.
It's constant cruelty. What's also interesting for me is anytime there's a response to anything I write, and you get it more than I, the response to your radio show. There is a lot of the responses here were the justification of solitary confinement. Although we didn't talk about race, in some of the responses, some of them did, the racism of the people writing in, and the need for visiting more brutality on people who've committed crimes was kind of astonishing.
Yeah.
I didn't expect to get a lot of mail supporting solitary confinement and punitive behavior.
Let me raise one thing here, too, because the other aspect of this that is really telling in terms of the character of the society is the number of children who are held in solitary confinement. And
right,
that is just, that's mind-boggling.
There's an article in, I forget the magazine, just came out now, about children in solitary confinement. Rikers Island was particularly bad about that in Manhattan, because they had a lot of young people coming into the system. The average age in, I think, I don't remember now exactly, it's either 18 or 20, was the average age of people in Rikers Island in solitary confinement. So, and these young people, by and large, they could be first-time offenders. I mean, the story that I told you about the man who was baked to death in Rikers Island, it just could easily have been, and there have been stories of younger people like that. So it is a horrific system, and you have the convergence of people making a buck out of the prison system, the brutality of guards, the underpayment of guards, and the helplessness. As a lawyer who's been in and out of prisons, I just tell you how helpless even I am in a prison to get things done or to effectuate change. You just go into a system where if you try and do something on behalf of somebody, the system attempts to render you helpless, either by keeping you waiting for extraordinary periods of time, or saying you don't have an appointment when you know you have an appointment, or saying that the prisoner is unavailable. So sometimes I'll travel cross-country or down to Florida or wherever. We'll make an appointment. I'm the only person often that the prisoner can see. I'll go there. They'll hold me out 6, 7, 8 hours, and then I can't see him, and I have to come back. And that's not uncommon. I have political cases where representatives of foreign governments get the same kind of treatment if they have a jail prisoner in the United States. So the total arbitrariness of political systems is really hard to understand. We have words like due process. We have words like justice. We have words like, or we have concepts, fourth, fifth, different amendment concepts. But nothing is applicable fundamentally in the prison system.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with attorney Martin Garbus. Martin is an attorney who specializes in fighting constitutional rights cases in the U.S. and human rights cases in countries all over the world. One of the things that you speak about in your article, and I thought this was extremely important, is that in addition to all of the other things that we've been talking about, all of the other dangers tied up with either ignoring this or allowing it to go on unopposed, allowing ignorance to be able to take root there, you talk about this situation in and of itself posing a great moral danger. The whole idea of this great moral danger that's posed by what happens in the prisons, and especially in relation to the cruel and unusual punishment that goes on, and solitary confinement, and all of the other social relations that are enforced there. You talk about this moral danger, and I thought actually one of the things that I was getting from reading that is that it also plays a role, and this is linked to the question of genocide and the sort of creating a certain public lack of awareness around genocide or lack of caring around it. That kind of inhuman morality that gets carried out in prison does seem to have an impact on dehumanizing all of the rest of society, and that's really a big part of the moral question here, isn't it?
First of all, prison population is very substantial now. Prison population ultimately gets out. Guards work within the system, and then they get out. And while they're in prison, they're living in this totally oppressive, racist system where the basically blacks and Hispanics are fair game. There's no way that people who get released from jail can look upon this society with any hope that they'll be treated differently. They also know the history. They know there is a high probability that they're going to wind up back in jail for one reason or another. They know to go back to jail means that they're going to be brutalized. If I were in the street after having been in solitary confinement and had a weapon or had something, the last thing I would permit is myself to go back to jail. And how that is reflected in violence counts and killings in all kinds of social behavior should be apparent. One of the very strange things is how little statistics we have about all this. Even to find out how many people are in solitary confinement is very, very difficult. The last numbers we have go back to 2006. They may not be reputable. You now have overcrowding. The prison population has enlarged greatly. So the numbers are probably well over 100,000 people at any one time in solitary confinement in American prisons. Mm. And that's extraordinary.
Yeah. In terms of this, though, too, it seems to me, at least I think anyway, that this moral dilemma, this moral problem, this moral danger that we're talking about, that it's not just in terms of how the prisoners will react outside of society, but there's a certain element of, and I think this is extremely important, in order to get people to be good Germans, there has to be a certain amount of dehumanization of all of the other people, all of those who are in the jails, you know, in the eyes of the general population, which allows the, you know, and it really does, it allows the entire society to function in a way that, you know, basically, if you were to look back at it and say, oh, it's abhorrent, how could anybody do this? But actually, this kind of treatment of people in prisons and that dehumanization of the people in prisons actually carries out as long as people on the outside look at it as, okay, it's not a problem. The moral danger is that people themselves in the society at large become very dehumanized.
I think what you're saying is true. I think that these stories, whatever I have in my article, these stories have been around for a very, very long time. I don't think there's anything in my article that couldn't have been written 30, 40, 50 years ago. And it's something that society has learned to equate the word solitary confinement with a need for that person to be in solitary confinement. And that marks that person or that class of people that wind up there as incorrigibly flawed.
And it does allow us to sort of turn a blind eye to the things like I was mentioning earlier, Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, CIA,
yes,
black sites.
Yes.
You know, one of the things, though, I was thinking about in relation to this, and when I read that, what you said, I was thinking about this thing of, you mentioned earlier the question of race in prisons and the prison population, and the fact that there are, you know, at least half of the almost 2 million people that are in jail these days are black or Latino. And you look at that, and there's a genocidal component that is really, I think.
Yes.
Go ahead.
You can look at what's going on in Ferguson and other places. And, of course, this is evocative of lynching in the 30s and 40s. So, yes, I think there is a genocidal component. You know, York's statement that 50%, the maximum security prisons that I have been to, are, at least to my eye, 90 to 95% black and Hispanic. And, so that if you look at the statistics as the prisons become more secure, i.e. as the prisoners have committed, let's say, more serious felonies, the racial disparities continue. I will go into maximum security prison when there will be 50 prisoners in the room every at a visiting hour with their wives and kids. And they'll all be black, and I'll be the only white person in the room. The guards are generally, in these situations, all white. So the same kind of problems that you have, whites oppressing blacks, whites in charge, whites being self-protective, whites, it's a system that encourages cruelty, it encourages racism, it encourages bonding of the guards and the prisons, most maximum security prisons, are kept under control by an uneasy alliance between the gangs in the prison, Crips, Bloods in California, and the guards. And those individuals who can't make peace with either the gangs or the guards are the ones who suffer. And there are many, many who cannot make peace with those two groups. And they're the primary people. And again, like this ex-Marine who was all by himself. He had no, although he's black, he had no identification with any group. He was just homeless and alone, and there was nobody in the prison to look out for him.
Hmm. You know, and one of the things, I think this will be the last question we'll have a chance to get into, but one of the things that really gets me, too, is that when you look at, like, what we've become inured to, you know, the idea of Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, the CIA black sites, the knowledge that these things are going on out there, that torture is being sort of, like, farmed out to various other regimes that will do the dirty work of the U.S. somewhere else. You know, but you look at all this, and there's this point of, to the extent, and this is why I think things like your editorial and the work that you're doing is extremely important, and for everybody to do this, because so long as this is kept from our sort of our day-to-day vision or our understanding of what's going on in society, this genocidal assault against black and Latino people can have horrible repercussions. Can really, I mean, when you're talking about a genocidal assault, genocide is genocide, and this is something that if we don't speak up, if we don't do something to stop this crime against humanity, humanity's in deep trouble.
You can put a guy in prison for whatever, it could be a minor charge, it could be a drug charge. When he comes out, it's going to be hard not to be violent, given what happens to him. And given the fragile nature of all our psychological systems, the healthiest, the most prominent amongst us, by societal standards, put in prisons like these, in the cells that I describe in the article, there's no way you don't break apart and fall apart.
You know, one thing, too, that I've learned over the years, too, is that there is an ability for not just for humans in general, but a particular ability for prisoners who begin to actually understand and look beyond even just sort of the day-to-day relations they have in prison, but look to, like, what got them there, how they got there, what does this have to do with the bigger things going on in society to transform in ways that are actually quite remarkable.
There are some great, great people in prisons doing great, great work with prisoners. The amount of money for it is dried up. Nonetheless, there are some very committed volunteers who really give of their lives to help.
All right, Martin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Take care now. Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with attorney Martin Garbus about the cruel and unusual punishment of solitary confinement in U.S. prisons. It's unconstitutional, illegal, and yet extremely normal, and it's a genocidal assault, part of a whole genocidal assault against black and Latino people, and we need to stand up against it. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Silence and social control, black rage is found in all. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember all these kinds of things, and then I don't fear so bad.
All right, welcome back. That was more of Lauryn Hill with Black Rage Sketch. All right. A very, very moving and powerful song. Now, I played Lauryn Hill at the first break and the second break because it's a really good example of what this next segment of the show is going to be all about. I want to present to you something that I don't often get a chance to do, and that's a piece of work, a piece of art, a poem, and a song that we're going to play all the way through, that we're going to play from beginning to end. And I want you to get a chance to hear this, you know, because these are times, these intense times demand an intense response, and they oftentimes bring forward that intense response from all kinds of artists. Creative projects in the arts, literature, poetry, music, art, dance, and more are a vital component of an emerging mood and spirit of resistance. And this show is all about, this week, this show is all about, it's a month of resistance to mass incarceration, police brutality, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. And art has a whole lot to do with standing up against that. You know, creative projects in the arts, literature, poetry, music, art, dance, and more are a vital component of an emerging mood and spirit of resistance. It's exactly what we need. Now think about this. August 9th, American racial tensions were sparked alive when police officer Darren Wilson shot and killed unarmed Mike Brown. Artists saw this as an urgent time to use their voices. Facts are facts. Police brutality and nationwide militarization have been in high gear. Aggressive dinosaurs on steroids discriminating against black and brown people in Ferguson proved nothing has changed. There is a growing wave of artistic expression in response. Artists allow for the political message to be stretched. Through poetry, song, dance, and art, people can stop. People can think and listen. Mainstream media does not participate in communicating an unbiased truth about all this. What the news tells is skewed towards corporate interests, thereby backing the interests of those with power. Truth is one of the most important words in our language. Youth, drawn to all kinds of art, are ultimately looking to connect with a message and asking big questions. Racism, discrimination, class, poverty, mass incarceration, and excess militarism are all core issues involved in the outrageous numbers of shootings by police. Since youth are influenced by art, teachings and answers to questions can be given by artists and artists seen as healers. Here's a few examples. The first is a poem called "I Am Not That Corpse" by D. Noble.
I am not Michael Brown. I wasn't gunned down and left in the street like trash. Police aren't stomping over my dried blood while bombing my hood with tear gas. My mama's face ain't drowning in putrid tears and thick globs of snot. My daddy's soul ain't on fire crying while his baby boy shot. My niggas ain't weeping as they reminisce on the last we shared last weekend. My black flesh ain't been pierced by a white cop bullet. My blood ain't leaking. I ain't Eric Garner. I ain't got cops on my neck just squeezing and squeezing and squeezing and squeezing till they choke me lifeless and my black ass stop breathing. I ain't John Crawford. Police didn't murder me in Walmart for holding a fake weapon on sale in the toy section. My baby mommy have to hear the police chief say the cops made the right decision while she tries to explain why I'm never coming home to our small children. I'm not Jonathan Farrell, not Ezell Ford. I'm not Sharice Francis, not Renika Boyd. I'm not Renisha McBride. I'm still alive. So the question remains, how can I not ride? No excuses, but the truth is, we'd rather be dead. That's why we march holding signs of I Am Trayvon above our heads. That's the wishful thinking of the already defeated, an empty slogan for those who have already conceded that this world can't be radically changed. Thus, there's no incentive to organize and strategize to redirect our lives towards revolution. We'd rather be walking bullseyes, wondering if we're nets when they're shooting. We scream we bout that life, but our lack of action says we bout that slow death. We bout heavy sobs in between stolen breaths. We bout pictures on t-shirts, candlelight vigils, funerals, hashtag memorials. Our lives are rushed dress rehearsals for death. Long prayers with Jesus help us feel alive when we just lambs for the slaughter. Sitting ducks waiting to be plucked out of the broke levee's water. And while we play possum, they get more ruthless. Notice the pigs' pistols have replaced the Klan's nooses. They institutionalize the terror. We pay taxes to the institutions. We lay prostrate for the state. Hold silent vigils at the courthouse gates instead of dragging out the cops, jurors, and judges with their heads on stakes. We place foolish faith in their district attorneys. Meanwhile, they place our kids on gurneys. We chant no justice, no peace, but suffer injustice in peace. We scared to scream off the police, let alone bucket the beast. We think we big meats, but they running the streets all to the teeth with a license to kill. And all the black corpses they leave behind are proof that they will. Mm. They yell, don't move, then shoot when we steal. but I ain't been shot yet. I am not Oscar Grant. I am not Ayanna Jones, a 7-year-old girl shot by the police while asleep in her own home. I'm alive, which means there is no excuse to not struggle for revolution, study for revolution, organize for revolution. I am alive. I must revolt. We must win.
All right, once again, that was a poem, I Am Not That Coarse, by Dee Noble. It's a powerful poem performed at the Greensboro, North Carolina Stop Mass Incarceration Network chapter's kickoff meeting for the October Month of Resistance to Stop Mass Incarceration. All right, coming up next is a really interesting song. It's one of those rare moments where all kinds of people that you might not expect to ever step up like this have stepped up. This song is called Don't Shoot, and it features an all-star team of hip-hop artists, including The Game, Rick Ross, Diddy, and 2 Chainz. They've all collaborated on this track dedicated to Michael Brown. And it also includes Fabulous, Whale, DJ Khaled, Swiss Beatz, Yo Gotti, Currency, Problem, King Pharaoh, and R&B vocal trio TGT.
Our Lord, grant us good in this world and good in the life to come keep us safe from the torment of the fire. As we keep our hands up high and scream for justice. Ferguson, rest in peace Mike Brown and all the young soldiers out there. God help us.
Time to take a stand and save our future.
Like we all got shot, we all got shot.
Throwing up our hands, don't let them shoot us.
Cause we all we got, we all we got. God ain't put us on the earth to get murdered, it's murder. God ain't put us on the earth to get murdered, it's murder. Don't put your weapons at me.
Seen the pictures, feel the pain. Scandalous how they murder son. Tired of them killing us. I'm on my way to Ferguson. Talk to Tip, I talk to Diddy. Then my brother's walking with me. Mother's crying, stop the riots. We ain't got a chocolate city. I seen Cole out there. Felt I should go out there. They left that boy 4 hours in the cold out there. They killing teens. They killing dreams.
It's murder.
Yo, come on. We gotta stick together, we all we got. We when we police got. Taking shots and I ain't talking about Ciroc. I'm talking about Emmett Till, I'm talking about Azelle Ford. Yeah. Talking about Sean Bell, they never go to jail for. Trayvon over Skittles, Mike Brown, Cigarello. Story keep repeating itself like a Biggie instrumental. America's a glass house and my revenge is mental. Revenge is rather mental. Use my brain and throw a cocktail through a window.
I got the keys to the city, still we left in the cold. Hands in the sky, still was left in the road. Ribbon in the sky, Michael Brown, another soul. Stole by the system, black men, we pay the toll. The price is your life, Uncle Sam on a slice. Black dress code, now we looting in the night. Now we throwing Molotovs in this Holocaust. And I know they hate to hear me screaming, I'm a boss.
Time to take a stand and save our future.
Like we all got shot, we all got shot.
Throwing up our hands, don't let them shoot us.
Cause we all we got, we all we got. Put us on the earth to get murdered, it's murder. God ain't put us on the earth to get murdered, it's murder. Don't put your weapons at me.
Tired of the okie doke. You lying, you Pinocchio. Driving while black, tell me where am I supposed to go? Gunshots hit the car, now I got the Holy Ghost. Excessive force was a drug, then they overdosed. Got us trying to protest, it's a slow process. Heard it's a lot of rotten eggs in the crow's nest. People praying on their feet, police holding on with heat. Turned on the news and seen a tank rolling down the street.
I seen a lot of ice water toss, and I know it's for a cause. My only question is, what we doing for the loss of Mike Brown? Cause right now I challenge you to use your talents to speak up, and don't you ever let him silence you. Cause action speaks louder than words, that's what I heard. Shot down with his hands up, that's what occurred. Man, that sound absurd. Matter of fact, to me that sound like murder. We want justice. just.
And your game, I had a crib out there. I used to live out there. So I know how niggas feel out there. People stressing, protesting, unity is a blessing. So it's time we come together, use our voices as a weapon. I am Michael Brown, cause I stand for what he stand for. News say we looting, paint pictures like we some animals. My NWA, CMG, hollering rest in peace, easing. Off the police.
Heard another brother slain out of St. Louis. I'm sure the mother feel the pain, but what you famous doing? I'm sure the general population trying to be more active. But when the light finally catches you, you ice challenge. Okay, and I support the ALS just like the rest of them. But you have yet to pay your debts, so you just flexing it. Cause everybody care for a minute, stop. People only there for a minute, stop. And what's the point of giving if you ain't giving your all? We never get in the head, might as well give up your heart. Love.
Got my hands up, what else am I supposed to do?
Mike Brown. And all other
tell me
soldiers
the love for everything
that will not be on the news
through.
And televised.
Mercy, 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 mercy. Oh. Only God can save us. Mercy, mercy,
as we lead in peace.
Martin Luther King had a dream, but they ain't respecting Jesse up out here. And they don't really respect Obama out here. Yeah. Lights out, go dark, it's like a nightmare. How we go for play the game, but they ain't playing fair. Playing fair. It's going down, Armageddon right here. Right here. Right now, not on TV, but right here. Put your flags in the air if you don't really care. We need justice, yeah. We need justice here.
Oh. I heard he surrendered, but we all saw how they did him. Television broadcasts a confused country. I'm a resident of a nation that don't want me. What's done is done. The town erupts in fury, and I'm already hearing about this lopsided jury. Three faces like his, the rest another story. A lot of us are for money to act more worried.
The revolution has been televised. If I sit here and don't do nothing, homie, that's genocide. Oh, damn, we have arrived. And who cares who ain't on our side? Cause we on our own. How you preach peace to a family that just lost their own? My Brody game just banged my line like we gotta do something. All that marching and that peace ain't gonna do nothing. Oh, get my mom sorry, I'm ready to raise the police to let the animals out the cage. Oh, Lord, it's
time to take a stand and save our future. Like we are got shot, we are got shot. Throwing up our hands, I'll let them shoot us. Cause we are, we got, we are, we got. God ain't put us on the earth to get murdered. It's murder. God ain't put us on the earth to get murdered. It's murder. Don't point your weapons at me.
Stand up.
All right, welcome back. Once again, that was Don't Shoot. It's a track from rapper The Game featuring Rick Ross, 2 Chainz, Diddy, and many others that's dedicated to Michael Brown, who was murdered by the police in Ferguson, Missouri. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And don't forget, October 22nd, the National Day of Protest Against Police Brutality, Repression, and the Criminalization of a Generation is coming up, so look for it in your area. All right? We're going to go out now with a little bit more of Lauryn Hill.
Black rage founded, fed us self-hatred, lies and abuse, while we waited and waited, spiritual treason, this grid and its cage.